Welcome to The Cauldron, sponsored by the Canada History Society with Dr. Barry Goff. In this series, we examine early British Columbian history by exploring the great turning points of BC's past, where politics, ambition, and geography meet in a crucible of change. Today, we turn to Vancouver Island and to a railway whose very iron lines reshaped its destiny, the Esquimalt and Nanaimo Railway. Conceived in the ferment of Confederation and driven by the promises of Sir John A. Macdonald, the ENN was more than a line of track through forest and mountain. It was a political bargain, a settler's artery, and a lifeline binding the island to the ambitions of a young Dominion. From the coal mines of Nanaimo to the harbors of Esquimalt and Victoria, the railway altered settlement, industry, and power. It carried more than timber and coal. It carried the weight of Ottawa's promises, the struggles of island communities, and the imprint of colonial and Indigenous encounters. We also explore the impact of the Dunsmuir family of the railway and the development of British Columbia by the Gilded Age businessmen. Its impact is written into the very landscape of British Columbia's capital region, shaping the development of Victoria and securing Vancouver Island's place in Canada's national story. In this episode, we set the ENN upon the tracks of history, examining how this railway came to be, what it meant for Victoria, and how its legacy continues to echo across the island today.
Thank you for joining me on this additional episode of our Cauldron series. And today's episode is the saga of the ENN Railway, the Esquimalt and Nanaimo Railroad. It's a story of success, of rise, and then, of course, of collapse. And it's a study in technology, industrial technology specifically. The story is told in numerous histories of British Columbia, not well in the general history of the Pacific Northwest or in Canadian history, but it is told in a personal way by James Audain in his book From Coal Mine to Castle. James Audain's son, Michael, is the distinguished philanthropist. This is the story of Robert Dunsmuir and his wife, Joan, who boarded a ship in 1849, destined for the far side of the world. The ship was the Peking. They came around Cape Horn. They arrived at the mouth of the Columbia River, where the Peking was caught on a sandbar, and their son was born there. Anyway, little James was born on the Columbia River at the entrance, and he was one of two brothers. The other one was Andrew, and they had 10 sisters. Now, Robert and Joan had been educated at Kilmarnock Academy in Scotland, so they were well educated. And Robert told Joan, "Well, if you come with me to the far side of the world where there's great opportunity in the mining of coal, I will build you a castle." And so it was from coal mine to castle. They came immediately to a place called Fort Rupert among the Kwakwallawak peoples. Near the northern end of Vancouver Island on the east side of the island. And after this had stopped because of one reason or another, the quality of the coal was not very good there. There were difficulties with the Scots miners who were working for them or under their control, and there were difficulties with Indigenous peoples. They began to search for other locations for coal, and in Nanaimo, at a place called the Wellington Mine, they found their greatest opportunity, the greatest seam. And Robert, with his tremendous financial acumen, purchased the Wellington Mine, and that became the chief source of his initial revenues. So all of a sudden, he was a wealthy baron of coal and a great industrialist. Now, in those days, Nanaimo was connected to Victoria by steamship service that would consume almost a day. The Malahat Road was not built until the 1912. So, in short, the only chance of getting coal from Nanaimo to Victoria and then on to San Francisco, which is where the main market was by a future railroad. And this becomes then the subject of the political fights that went on. Let me diverge for just a moment and say that our story is one of industrial capitalism set loose in an era of untrammeled development, all backed up by legal authority, of course, British Columbia, Canada, and of course also funded and capitalized by British and American capitalists. Cain and Hopkins call this gentlemanly capitalism. And sure enough, this is what was happening here. We have the situation in which, in the post-Hudson Bay Company era, the province of British Columbia becomes what I might call the entrepreneurial state. And it has lands to give away and resources of those lands in exchange for the industrial development that is going to take place there, whether it's a mine to be developed or some timber leases, or in this particular case, the railroad. Now, in 1871, when British Columbia became part of the Canadian Confederation, a promise of a railroad to be built to Pacific Tidewater was accepted. Also at that period of time, there was a desire for a dry dock to be built, a Dominion dry dock to be built, with support from the Canadian and the imperial governments in order to service the Royal Navy ships that were Esquimalt and to take in any commercial requirements that were made by shipping on this particular coast. But the thought that Victoria had not been given the terminus for this railroad became a seething point among the citizens of Vancouver Island. After all, Victoria was the capital city. Vancouver was not even then thought about. It did not come into existence until the late 1880s. The CPR does not come through on a regular service until 1886, 1887. So the spoiled child of Confederation, as British Columbia became to be called about this time, was receiving a lot of attention in Ottawa. And the conservative government of Prime Minister John A. Macdonald felt that he must take some action to demonstrate some minimal progress on the railroad. He had to show that he had wanted to help Victoria and Esquimalt. And accordingly, a brief sod-turning ceremony was held at Esquimalt on the 19th of July of 1873, heralding the commencement of the Esquimalt and Nanaimo Railroad. The railway was to continue north, crossing to the mainland at Seymour Narrows. And however, this link was not used. The Canadian Pacific Railway opted for the Fraser Canyon Vancouver route. From 1871 until 1883, Vancouver Island reeled under a severe depression. A major reason for this was the following decision by the British Columbia government. A grant to the federal government to help finance construction of the railway will put us a reserve on all unsettled lands for 20 miles on either side of the proposed line. The population of Vancouver Island north of Victoria was in an isolated state, and prospective settlers were unable to purchase land along the railway due to the federal grant, and thus resulted in some economic stagnation. To worsen matters, the provincial government in Victoria would not move to help finance a road from Victoria north, as it maintained that the road would be redundant once the railway was completed. We get, you will observe, the same sorts of arguments today versus of increasing the road traffic or to building some alternate or supplementary means of communication. In any event, the Conservative government, once begun on this, fell from grace. The Liberals were indifferent to the whole thing. The colonial secretary in London, Lord Carnarvon, offered his services in arbitration. And then Lord Dufferin, the governor general, observed the dispute with concern and suggested he visit British Columbia in an attempt to resolve the issue. He did come to Victoria in August 1876. He supported the Carnarvon terms of 74 that a railway should be built, but would have no talk of succession if this was not the case. And indeed, that highlights the argument that Dr. Helmkin had made so often before, that our love, that is, British Columbia's love of Confederation, was not a natural thing, but would be demonstrated by the material support, i.e., financial support, that Canada would give to the far western province. Well, the matters went back and forth for quite some time. And when William Smythe in 1883 became Cowichan's member in the Legislative Assembly and then the Premier of the province, all at once he had the political will and the backing to construct an Esquimalt and Nanaimo Railroad. So he pushed through what is called the Settlement Act of 1883, which the previous administration led by Premier Walcombe had obstructed. Smythe was very interested in the railroad, owing to the fact that his riding was on Vancouver Island. The former premier represented Cariboo in the legislature, and many on mainland British Columbia now felt Vancouver Island was singled out for special treatment. So by 1883, then the whole process had been put in place. Enter Robert Dunsmuir and James Dunsmuir of the Wellington Collieries of Nanaimo. Also tied in with this scheme were some powerful financiers, a man by the name of John Bryden, a Vancouver Island resident, also Charles Crocker, Leland Stanford of California, and Collis P. Huntington of New York. Now, these were big wheelers in the age of unrestricted capital development in the United States, which is sometimes referred to by the term Gilded Age. And it was not until American antitrust laws came into existence in the early 20th century that some of these big, powerful organizations were broken up. But these were the railway contractors. Huntington, for instance, introduced Australian hardwoods for on which to lay the track, and Crocker involved in communications, Wells Gray, for instance, and these other people, Leland Stanford of California, were powerful in raising finances. It might be added too that Robert Dunsmuir was very close with these persons. You may know that there is a town called Dunsmuir in Northern California. It's not very far from Mount Shasta, and it was one of the properties that was developed for coal production in California. And there were other places in the American West that were being developed by Dunsmuir as well. Now, James Dunsmuir, the son, had set up business in San Francisco to make all of this sort of thing possible. His brother was also there, and Portland also looking after shipping interests, though his dissolute life led to some difficulties. Incidentally, neither of the two sons was named in the will when Robert Dunsmuir dies. And in point of fact, Joan Dunsmuir receives the whole arrangement for the use of the estate for the future. Now, having 10 daughters, most of whom survived, allowed her to finance some very good arrangements with some leading aristocrats, naval officers, and others that were in the United Kingdom and in the United States. Back to the story about the railway. The contract for the construction of the Esquimalt and Nanaimo Railway was drawn up on the 20th of August, 1883, by Sir Alexander Campbell, Minister of Justice in the Macdonald government. Its provisions included completion within 3 years, with the Dunsmuir Syndicate receiving, get this, 2 million acres of land and a $750,000 grant from the federal Canadian government. With the completion of the railway in the year 1886, the social fabric of the island changed totally. Reliance on monthly steamer service from Vancouver to Nanaimo ceased as trains began to run daily in both directions. The first timetable of the Esquimalt-Nanaimo Railway took effect on the 30th of September, 1886. Initially, the ENN scheduled a passenger train leaving Russell Station in Esquimalt at 8 o'clock in the morning, arriving at Nanaimo at 11:40. Wonderful service. A southern-bound train left in Nanaimo at 2 o'clock, arriving at Russell's by 5:40. So agriculture now ceased to be a purely local industry as the trains transported up-island produce to the main centers. So too did lumbering increase dramatically. And so wood products and the production of cellular fibers began to become part of the economy as well. The Dunsmuirs developed their own systems for tugboats. They had a beautiful yacht. They dined in state. They were wealthy beyond anyone's imaginings. And they were typical of these great spirits of that age, these gentlemen capitalists, as Kane and Hopkins called them, doing their work in British Columbia. It was, you see, an arrangement that had been entered into by the proprietorial state on the one hand, and the business tycoons on the other. Here we see the government giving the lands, the federal government giving the lands. They've also come out of the provincial reserve, of course. And then there's a federal top-up of $750,000 grant. So this is the way things are done in those days. It's the same true in other circumstances today. A town needs a new football stadium, and the municipality is asked to give some financial support to make it all happen. It was a railway that linked all the communities together. And Ian Baird, who wrote a historic guide to the ENN Railway, stresses that the architecture of the various stations along the road were marvelous, and they resembled a certain style. But they were places or nodules of community development. Some of them had beautiful gardens, as in Duncan and in Nanaimo. Others were perched on the sides of Shawinigan Lake as another location. They had a resort station there called the Strathcona Hotel. It was built in the year 1900. Incidentally, for a while, the ENN ran very well and very, very successfully, but it was attractive to other purchasers. And after Robert Dunsmuir had died, the property became available, the industrial property, I should say, the corporation became available, and the Canadian Pacific Railway acquired the running stock, the access lines, and the stations. The existing Canadian Pacific Railway stations of Vancouver Island, and this is Baird writing 20 years ago, remain a visible and poignant architectural reminder of the early transportation of Vancouver Island prior to the construction of highways. The ENN Railway was begun in 1884, with the link to Nanaimo being completed in September 1886. In 1887, an extension was laid to Wellington to connect its coal mines and the growing communities of Victoria and Esquimalt. In 1888, a bridge across the Inner Harbour made Victoria rather than Russell's Station in Esquimalt, the terminus. And in 1905, the CPR acquired the ENN Railway from Dunsmuir and began a period of further expansion. Now, it was natural, of course, that in the course of time, with the introduction of the railway, and with the development of faster steamer traffic, that the power of the railway would begin to disappear. And this long slide into decrepitude and public indifference was really the triumph of the coming of the automobile. I mentioned the 1912 transit of the Malahat by a motor car. And this would only get better because As automobiles became better, metal roads or macadam became better, the bridges became better, the population increased, the desire for privacy increased, so too did the decline begin to appear for the CPR or ENN railway. So the slide begins early in the 20th century, or it's heralded early in the 20th century, perhaps is a better way of putting it. First World War gave added benefit for the line because it was on land and good for communications as well. But sooner or later, things began to decrease. Now, the CPR was running great coastal steamship services, as you know, with regular passage from Nanaimo to Vancouver and Vancouver to Victoria, Victoria to Seattle, sometimes with a connection to Anacortes, sometimes with a connection to Port Angeles. So these were powerful and fast steamers, and they were faster ways of getting from A to B than often were the trains, ENN trains, which had all these stops along the way. But the commercial traffic was important because bulk cargoes could be shipped. Also, ammunition and equipment for the military establishment at Esquimalt. These were important considerations, and the federal government kept up support for this and subsidies for a good long period of time. Now, our wonderful authority on the building of the railroad from the family side is described by Audain, James Audain, as mentioned. And it's interesting to note that one of the things that he quotes is from a letter written by Robert Dunsmuir to Joseph Hunter, who is the chief engineer of the building of the railway. And this is dated Victoria, 30th of April, 1884. Now, listen to these wonderful, abrupt, and complete instructions in one paragraph. As engineer in chief, you will at once proceed with the location of the line between Esquimalt and Nanaimo in accordance with agreement between Dominion Government and Esquimalt Railway Company, of which I am president. You will be expected to locate the line with the view of local expenditure in construction consistent with good work and to carry on work to completion without delay. You will be responsible for all expenditure in your department, returning proper vouchers duly signed to this office, and report to me your progress on the work as often as possible. Yours truly, Robert Dunsmuir. And so the work was at hand, and the railway was on its way. In the following extract from Bancroft's History of the Pacific, dealing with British Columbia, we have a nice resume of the full story. And I will read it because it's so succinct and it's so redolent of the ideas that I've been talking about today about commercial gentlemanly capitalism, finance, the railway age, and so forth. The railway contract that was made in 1883 for the ENN Railway called for a subsidy of $750,000 together with a liberal grant of land. The land was on the eastern side of the island, bounded by straight lines drawn from the head of Saanich Inlet to Muir Creek on the Fuca Straits, thence west to Crown Mountain, and thence north to Seymour Narrows, and on the east by the coastline to the line of commencement, including all coal, coal oil, ores, stones, clay, marble, slate, mines, minerals, and substances whatsoever thereupon, therein, and thereunder. From the tract there was excepted the portion lying to the northward of a line running east and west, halfway between the mouth of the Courtenay River and Seymour Narrows. For 4 years, commencing from December 19, 1883, the entire grant, excepting, of course, the mineral lands, was to be opened for agricultural settlement at the rate of a dollar an acre, the government issuing preemption records for 160 acres to actual settlers. For further information, see Act Relating to the Island Railway, 1883, in the Statutes of British Columbia for 1884. In the same statute was enacted that the Dominion government should take over and complete and operate as a Dominion work the dry dock at Esquimalt, being entitled to the lands, approaches, and plants belonging to it, and the appropriation of the imperial government, paying to the province the amount expended or remaining due for work and material, and a further sum of $250,000. In order to finally settle all disputes with the Dominion, it was also enacted that 3,500,000 acres in the portion of the Peace River District lying east of the Rocky Mountains and adjoining the Northwest Territory of Canada should be transmitted in one rectangular block to be located by the Dominion. The character of the ENN Railway was to be in all respects equal to that of the Canadian Pacific, with the same gauge, the alignments, gradients, and curvatures being the best that the physical features of the country could permit, the grades not to exceed 80 feet to a mile. The width of cuttings was to be 20 feet, and of embankments, 16 feet. All bridges, culverts, etc., were to be of ample size and strength, equal to the best description of work on the CPR. Sufficient rolling stock and all buildings necessary for the accommodation of traffic were to be furnished by the contractors of the ENN Railway. And finally, in August 1883, a contract was made with a party of capitalists for the construction of the Esquimalt and Nanaimo Railway and Telegraph Line, with a subsidy of $750,000, the amount to be contributed by the Dominion government, together with a liberal grant of land, the capital stock being $3 million. The contractors were required to commence work immediately and to complete and equip the line on or before the 11th of June, 1887, time being declared as the essence of the contract. And in default of such completion within date specified, the contractors were to forfeit the subsidy, land grant, and the amount to be deposited as security with the receiver general. And finally, the road with its equipment was to be exempt from taxation for 10 years after completion. And all the material used in its construction was to be admitted free of duty. The character of the line was to be in all respects equal to that of the CP, and the company was required to maintain it in running order and to work it continuously and in good faith. Now, there you have a lovely, succinct summary of the origins and the establishment of the ENN. You will notice at the conclusion of this, there was a reference to doing it forever and in good faith. So let me broadly return to some of our themes here. Here we have a rags to riches story, or almost. We have a couple from Kilmarnock coming to Victoria. The discovery of the great mines in Wellington, the need for railroads to link them to places of embarkation. We need a military assistance at Esquimalt as well. So that's where the federal government also comes into the story. We have Sir John A. Macdonald making his appearance. And at one time, as you may know, he was a member of Parliament for Victoria. And I didn't mention before, but when the final spike was driven near Lake Cowichan, in point of fact, he was there on the occasion to do the honors. It was a great dream of capitalism brought to a conclusion and triumph. It was a great vision of the industrial age that rail would be the generator of wealth and cheap transportation. It was to open up the resources of Vancouver Island, link them to the mainland and to the ports that would draw them the wealth of the island to the far corners of the world, as indeed San Francisco became such a prominent export place for Wellington Cole. As you know, Robert Dunsmuir dies early. Joan takes possession of the Craig Darroch Castle. Son James becomes Member of Parliament, then Premier of the province, and then later government, Lieutenant Governor of the province. And he moves into Government House in Rockland, where his mother is his neighbor. I should also recount that because Joan was the sole executor of the estate, the boys, the two sons, were at loggerheads with one another and very upset. And in fact, Joan and Andrew were at court with one another for quite some time, also James. And this became, incidentally, an international subject of some dispute and mirth, actually. And the legal story has never been fully told. Now we look at Craig Darroch Castle of Joan Dunsmuir's, and we look at Attlee Castle of James Dunsmuir. They're the only two castles in Western Canada, I guess you could say, west of Castle Loma, Toronto. But they are representative of the great barons of the age, of the great wealth of an empire, industrial empire that has passed. But in the telling now, and the saving of those two locations, one is a historic site, National Historic Site. The other one's a historic site as well of Canada. The other one is Royal Roads University. They're symbols of an age that has passed us by. Nowadays, such wealth and such dealings go on behind the scenes. Wealth is generated in the same ways, but it's not so visible. The two castles are looked on as curiosities and representations of earlier architecture, and they're very, very beautiful in not only their interior spaces and their design, but the craftsmanship and the gardens that are part of them. And I look on them as representations of the dream that Robert Dunsmuir had and how he convinced his wife Joan that they should go to the far side of the world and take a chance on this new bustling empire that was developing on Vancouver Island. So thank you for listening to this episode, and I hope you'll listen to others that are in the series. I call them the cauldron because the period 1871 to 1914 was the big churning time in the history of the province of British Columbia. So many things were being turned upside down, and you can see in the Robert and Joan Dunsmuir story an exact example of this, because here you have the infusion of two powerful persons joined in marriage and love, who are at the changing point of the whole history of the province, and particularly of Vancouver Island. And the ENN Railway is one example of the many things that they did, and the numerous changes that were to come in the industrial age to the province of British Columbia. So thank you very much. I'm Barry Goff, signing off for the Cauldron series. Please join me on another occasion. Thank you.